Welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. I have such a soft spot for today's guest, not only because I admire his bravery and his discipline and his insanely immersive research skills, but also because the last time AJ Jacobs was on the show, the episode won a Best Podcast of the Year award from the Orange County Press Club. That is the only time I've entered the podcast for an award, and AJ won it for us. So as AJ would say, huzzah. He is the author of 9 books, including the New York Times bestsellers, The Year of Living Biblically, The Know-It-All, Drop Dead Healthy, and The Puzzler. He puts his whole life into these books, reading the entire encyclopedia for The Know-It-All and living the literal commandments of the New and Old Testament for living biblically. He's been on the show with me 3 times in the past, as far back as 2007. People are doing the math, they'll realize we're getting old. His latest in the spirit of the Year of Living Biblically is The Year of Living Constitutionally, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Constitution's Original Meaning. No idea what could have possibly brought that timely topic to his mind, but we'll find out. In addition to providing a great history lesson and a hilarious memoir, it's got a lot of implied lessons on how to be a more thoughtful and critical reader, how to slow down your thinking and your writing, and how it sometimes takes a village to write a book. Some of our past guests have suggested writing your books in longhand. AJ wrote this book using a quill pen and parchment paper, so we will talk about how that experience may have changed his writing. We'll also chat about making yourself and your family guinea pigs for your work and how to set up a rule system to do that, researching a bottomless topic and when to know you've done enough. Walking the political tightrope in divided times, as well as how this book changed AJ's thinking on a variety of topics and the impact of the project. I should also mention AJ is the host of the wildly popular podcast, The Puzzler. You can check that out however you consume your podcasts. AJ Jacobs, welcome back.
Thank you. I love that intro. Let's win another award. I think we
Yes.
can do it.
So
Yes.
you have been way more productive than I have been since the last time we talked. So congratulations on that. I was telling someone that you're like the dad who hides our educational peas inside our mashed potatoes because you make it so much fun and easy to learn. Yes.
That is lovely. I hadn't heard that one. I did. A friend of mine said it's like bubble gum with broccoli, which actually sounds terrible because you don't want to be chewing your bubble gum with broccoli. But I take it as a compliment. I think it was meant as a compliment.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I'm sticking with my peas and mashed potatoes. Those
Yes, much
go
better
a little
metaphor.
better together, yeah.
Yes.
So I hadn't read the Constitution since law school, and to be honest, I skimmed some of it this time, but it's in the news every damn day in some capacity. And to your point in the book, how many of us have actually sat down to read the text itself? The first thing that struck me, and I think you pointed this out in the book, are the random use of capital letters, which made me laugh all over again. I was like, are they just shouting at us? Or they didn't have Microsoft's bold feature. But
Right.
yeah, I'm curious as we set off to do this, A, tell me about what inspired the book. Let's start there. What got you down
Sure.
this project rabbit hole?
And I'm glad you like the capitalized letters because I do too. I get notes from copy editors all the time that I'm an overcapitalizer. But now I know that I have a long tradition behind me. Ben Franklin wanted all nouns in the English language capitalized, not just proper nouns, but
Oh.
like lamp.
Wow.
But anyway, I got the idea, like you said, mostly because it seemed extremely timely. Several years ago, as you mentioned, I wrote a book called The Year of Living Biblically, where I tried to follow all the rules of the Bible as literally as possible. So that meant the Ten Commandments, but it also meant growing a huge beard and not wearing clothes made of two different kinds of fabric and all those other hundreds of obscure rules. And that book had the two motivations, which are very similar to the two motivations for this one. The first was I knew nothing about religion. I grew up in a very secular home. As I said in the book, I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. No offense to the Olive Garden. So I wanted to learn about religion and my heritage, and I like to learn by doing, by getting inside a topic and diving in. But the second reason was that I wanted to talk about biblical literalism and all of these millions of people who say they follow the Bible literally, and therefore, since the Bible says homosexuality is a sin, therefore it must be a sin. And my feeling was, well, they were following some of the Bible literally, but there was a whole bunch of other stuff that they were not following literally, and they were just picking and choosing. So I sort of wanted to show what it would like, what would be like to be the ultimate fundamentalist. And it's not a great way to live. I don't recommend it. There are wonderful things that I did during that year, like I learned a lot about gratitude and forgiveness, but stoning adulterers is not one I recommend. I used very small stones, by the way, in case anyone's worried. So I always thought there could be a similar book about the Constitution because, A, I know very little. Unlike you, I didn't go to law school, so I never read it, or even skimmed it. And I thought this would be an amazing way to learn about the Constitution by living it, by trying to follow it as they wrote it back in 1789. And then the other reason was that there's a similar movement now in law in the Supreme Court called originalism, which is the idea that we should be basing our decisions based on the original meaning of the Constitution from 230 years ago. And this has resulted in some very controversial decisions that have affected millions of lives, from women's health and Dobbs to gun control and religion. So I thought, well, let me try to be the ultimate originalist and actually to take them at their word and follow the Constitution using the mindset and technology of 1789 and see what I can learn, see what works and what doesn't. So I did. I spent a year, I carried an 18th century musket around New York City for my Second Amendment rights. I gave up social media and wrote with a quill pen and wrote pamphlets. And I quartered a soldier in my apartment, as is my Third Amendment right. So it was a fascinating year, and I learned a lot. And I learned about what I think we need to move on from the founding era, but also some unexpected wisdom from the founding era that needs to perhaps be revived. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, as you were reading the text itself, what surprised you, given all the news that we consume every day and what we're told about the Constitution? What was the gap between what you had understood it said and what it actually says?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things that are surprising. Well, first of all, just it alternates between some of the most beautiful and inspiring writing I've ever read. Like those 52 first words, the preamble, we the people of the United States in order for a more perfect nation. And it talks about the blessings of liberty and the general welfare. It's just wonderful. And then it gets into the actual setup of the government and it becomes a lot less inspiring. It becomes like the instructions to like a really complicated role-playing game. And then on top of that, there are parts in those sections that are just so archaic, you can't believe it. The preamble seems almost timeless with these ideas of liberty, but then you get to a part where it's talking about legalized piracy, that Congress can grant a letter of marque and reprisal, which is basically privateering. You can go and, if you're a fisherman, put some guns on your boat and go capture enemy ships and keep the booty for yourself. And this is how we won the Revolutionary War. So it was a big deal at the time. And then you get to parts that are just so horrifying and offensive. They use euphemisms like, servitude, but they're talking about slavery. And what's interesting is they're still in the Constitution, even though the amendments have abolished slavery. And if it were up to James Madison, those parts would not be in there. He thought that when you did an amendment, you should rewrite the Constitution. It should be like a Google Doc, like so you don't see the ugly passages. But he was overruled, and we have these amendments at the end. And one of my advisors had an interesting point. He said, "This is it's disturbing, but it's also good because you can see the progress we've made. It's right there in the Constitution, and you can see that we have made some progress. We've got a long way to go, but it has been a general arc towards a better, a more perfect union."
Yeah, I do kind of agree with that. It is interesting to see where we've been and be reminded of that, right there. They really go after the Native Americans, which they, obviously they're called Indians. I mean, I understand they weren't paying taxes, and I guess that was their gripe with them, but it's wildly offensive
And it is
and so aspirational at the same time. Yeah.
exactly. It is one of my advisors, Larry Lawrence Tribe from Harvard, said it was like in quantum mechanics when you have a particle and a wave at the same time. So the Constitution is a At the same time, this amazing document of liberation and democracy, and also a document of elitism and even a little slaveocracy. So it is it contains multitudes, as I say.
Yeah, I love that
I
analogy
didn't come up with
by
that
tribe.
phrase. I
No, it was
don't.
very good. It was very good. Well, tell me about tribe and choosing the experts, because there's a mound of constitutional experts out there. And tell me a little bit about choosing your posse on who would advise you for this.
Oh yeah. Well, I love that is for all of my projects. I know I'm going in there as a layperson. So I for my Bible book, I had a collection of rabbis and ministers and priests and scholars, and I loved that. So I thought I'm going to replicate it with this, and I tried for as much ideological diversity as I could. So I wanted people who were so progressive, they sort of saw the Constitution as textual Plato and they could make it whatever they wanted, versus the more conservative who were said we cannot change a single letter. And I do mean letter, because one of them said we should not be capitalizing the Supreme Court. The S in Supreme Court in the Constitution is lowercase. And so the fact that we capitalize it is a big problem. So I loved talking to these folks, and I also wanted a lot of historians, because originalists are not historians. The justices are not historians, but they are trying to get inside the minds of people from the founding, and that is hard. And according to the historians I talked to, the worldview from the late 1700s is so foreign to us. It's so different. It's a, the phrase, the past is a foreign country. They really explained to me how different they viewed the world, which is another reason why I think only looking at the original meaning in the past is a mistake, because we can never get into their minds. And even if we could, it's not really the society we want to build.
Well, yeah, just to point back to the frequent use of Indians in the Constitution on what was on their mind. I mean, they were so new to the country at that point that you're right. It really was a foreign land. I mean, it bears no resemblance to where we're living
And
today.
some ways, in a bad way, like with the Indians, but in some ways, I would argue it they looked at the world, for instance, they were really obsessed with virtue and this idea of responsibilities. I talk in the book about how there's a Bill of Rights, but the Bill of Responsibilities would be in there, but it was so implied. It was everyone was like, of course you have a responsibility to your country. You go on the bucket brigade. Everyone's a firefighter. Everyone, all male. Adult males were in the militia, and I don't want everyone to be in the militia now. Like, I that's not, but I am saying this idea of responsibility to your country, to your community, to your world, that I love. And whether that's mandatory AmeriCorps for everyone, whatever it is, I think we need to reclaim some of that.
Yes.
that worldview. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And then tell me a little bit about setting up the rules for yourself. So you dressed in 18th century garb, you carried a musket, you wrote with a quill pen. I think you were like also pretty strict with yourself on electricity now and then.
Exactly. Yes.
So your family gets implicated in the grand experiment. So tell me a little bit about knowing the rules, where to draw the lines, what you allowed yourself, what you didn't, and how your family adapted to the new
Yeah,
world order.
well, as you know, I do love, I like to go all in. I commit to the bit, as my son says. So, and I do think dressing the part actually has its advantages. It gets you into the mindset. So, yeah, I wore my tricorn hat. I had to order it over ye old internet. So there were times I used the internet. I used candles. I started with beef tallow candles, which smelled
Oof.
like meatloaf, according to my wife. So I had to switch to beeswax. I wrote with a quill, a goose quill, which is actually one of the wonderful parts of this experiment, because writing with a goose quill, I think, changed the way I wrote and thought. It may I wasn't tempted by the pings and dings and distractions of the internet, and I do think it makes you think more deeply and subtly, at least I hope so. And I don't think everyone needs to go back to quills, but just writing offline is so important, and thinking offline. I'm trying to
Yes.
think. Oh, and so dressing also, I had to. I became grateful for some small things that I was never grateful for. I'm first of all grateful for democracy. That was one big takeaway, but also grateful for elastic socks, elastic in your socks. Almost as important, because I would wear these 18th century style woolen socks or stockings, and they would just fall down to my ankles. And so every morning I had to put on sock belts. They weren't even garters. I feel garters is too fancy a word. They were just little tiny belts, like for a little Smurf sized person. And you had to put them around your socks so they wouldn't fall down. So the amount of time that it took to just live life back then is really remarkable.
But you had all that time back because you weren't on social media, so it just went to putting your socks on, right?
Exactly. I do think that's it. That's right. No Netflix.
So it strikes me that you probably couldn't have lived this 18th century experience without 21st century technology, because it requires the internet to find an authentic 18th century musket and old socks. And as we'll talk about, even the conversation with James Madison that you had on ChatGPT couldn't have been done 2 years ago. So there was some lovely irony, I thought, in the requirement of today's world to access yesterday's world.
Exactly. It is ironic because, yeah, the internet is an amazing tool for historical reenactors. I don't know how they did it before the internet, but there is all the, I did as part of this. I joined the 3rd New Jersey Revolutionary War Reenactor Regiment, and I would have joined the Constitutional Convention Reenactor Society, but there is no such thing. Because I think, people like the muskets, they like the loud noises, they want to do the battle, they don't want to be signing papers. But so I had to do that. Was the closest I could find. But they are really committed to authenticity. Some of them are called stitch counters. The really hardcore reenactors are stitch counters, meaning they count the number of stitches in the original clothing and try to replicate that number. One of them lost his toe to frostbite because he went to Valley Forge and refused to wear shoes in the winter in the snow because the soldiers didn't. So, and he was in my regiment. So some people, they are committed, and I respect them for that. I wouldn't lose a toe myself. I don't think it's worth it, but.
Yeah, I have to say, this strikes me as such a wacky hobby. And I guess especially because the world is so embroiled in real life war right now that I can't fathom, anybody ever wanting to reenact, an Iraq gunfight or something.
That
But
is interesting,
I was
right?
going to ask you about that, of like kind of what's going on here with folks' nostalgia for war, 'cause I know they do this with Civil War battles and obviously the Revolutionary War. And I was wondering if you came away from that experience thinking if that says something about our culture. Like, I don't know if other countries do this, but it seems so weird.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. And I also thought so. I will say I gained a lot of respect for the reenactors. First, because I don't think that they have false nostalgia. Like they realize it was a hard time and it was a smelly, it was a dangerous, I mean, not to mention, of course, racist and sexist time. And they realize that. So they aren't necessarily glorifying it. I think for them, a lot of them, it fulfills this need to pay homage to these people who went through so much. And because you read, I mean, some of the most startling books I read were the memoirs by Revolutionary War soldiers or Revolutionary War prisoners, and just the hardships are just unimaginable. So I do see, and I will say it's not all fighting. I mean, they do food and they do clothing. So that made me understand the allure. I don't imagine I'm going to be in the hobby. That's what they call it, the hobby, like how New York City is the city. So
It's
they say,
capitalized, yeah.
yeah, that's probably capitalized. So I don't think I'll be committed to the hobby for life, but it was fun and interesting to meet these people who were very intellectually engaged. One of them said, "I love it because I come here and I talk about history and philosophy as opposed to, you know, what the score was on last night's basketball game."
Well, that, okay. I like that. I like that.
Okay,
And
good.
I
You're
do
joining the
think
hobby. Did I
I'm
convert
joining
you?
the hobby. Yes. Well, I do think I mean, our country is so damn huge. And I think living in Southern California, you do feel very divorced from our country's history. And, you know, I was mentioning to you that our daughter last year moved to Maryland. And so I'm spending more time in the DC area. And it does give you a much more immediate feel for our origins than you get, you know, on the beaches of Southern California. So
Right.
I do have to say I do respect that. And you know, if you're going to lose a toe over it, then you know, I really have to respect that. So that's
Respect or be completely baffled by
Yes.
one.
Did you come away from that particular experience thinking about life a little differently or changing your views about anything?
I guess it was in the same genre as being grateful for elastic in my socks. There were, I mean, it's interesting because the whole project, there was sort of two themes. One was, we do not want to go back to the 18th century. It was a terrible place in many ways, as I said, sexist, racist, homophobic, I can't even imagine. And medicine, we have problems, as we were talking about before the show, with our healthcare system, but at least we don't have to have tobacco smoke enemas, which was a common,
Right.
com and they would, which was literally blowing smoke up your butt. They would put a hose in and they would blow smoke because it was supposed to be good for your stomach. So we don't want to go back to the 18th century. So that's one big theme. But the other big theme is, well, let's not throw the baby out with the gross, dirty, reused bathwater from the 18th century. There are also elements to their mindset that were worth revisiting. And one we talked about was the idea of virtue and sacrifice, and another is thinking offline. So and doing the reenactment, I think, was a good way to see both sides of that. You could see how horrible life was, but also you get to even something like the DIY, which I think has become big now among certain people. I loved, and I still love, making my own quills. Taking a turkey feather and carving it into a quill is very satisfying to being writing with something that you made yourself.
Going back to blowing smoke up your butt, there were I also wanted to point out there were so many nice embedded origin stories of a lot of phrases that I never knew where they came from. That was one. There was, I think, you know, where flaxen hair came from.
Right, flax actually does look like blonde hair. A and flash in the pan was another one that I
Oh,
learned,
yes, right.
which is comes from muskets. You put if You have to put gunpowder in the pan, which is like a little container by the trigger. And if the pan explodes but doesn't go into the muzzle, then it's just like a little explosion that means nothing because it actually doesn't force the bullet out. And I did love learning about 18th century language. I mean, it is, I love words like Grumbletonian, which was
Yes,
meant
yes.
someone who's a griper, a grumbler. So they have some wonderful word. Adam's ale, I guess, is water. So I try that. I try to break those out sometimes with the family, and it never goes over well, but I'll keep trying.
Behooves, yes, behooves.
Behooves. Oh yes, you had
Yes.
mentioned that you're a fan of the word
Yes, I
behooves.
love that word. Yes. And virtue. There was a lot of background on virtue that I didn't know the. I'm trying to remember now. There's some sexist origins to
Oh
the word.
yeah. Well, that was fascinating. The word virtue comes from the Latin for vir, means male, like virile. And because it was assumed that it was a male characteristic, women were these emotional, they were always thinking about themselves, those women and their emotions, whereas men had this virtue where they could rise above their emotions and think about the greater good. So it's a horrible origin for a word.
Yeah. Except
And
when it comes to virgins, because I feel like we're only obsessed about that with women and not men, but
oh, interesting.
I
That's
have
a
to
great
explore
point.
that. Yeah, I have to
I
explore
have
that.
I that might be another VIR. Well, I always wonder what the origins of what like sinister means. It comes from the Latin, I believe, for left-handed, because left-handed people were considered sinister. There was something wrong with them. So what do we do when we have a word that is very divorced from its origin now, and it's really embedded in our language? I mean, if we tried to get rid of them all, that would be a very hard thing to do.
Yes.
So, but on the other hand, some of them really do have offensive origins. Anyway, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, no, it is interesting because I think we are at a time in our culture and politics where we're trying to upend all of it, and I think that's part of the problem is people think we're doing it too fast, and it's ruining everything, and so yeah, that kind of gets to some of the basic
Right, it's a
problems I
problem.
think of what we're dealing with. Yeah.
I mean, it relates to, I think logicians talk about the genetic fallacy. And I'm not sure it's a fallacy, but it is an issue. Like, and the idea is something that had a bad origin, should we keep using it, even though the origin was bad? But so if a medication was tested in horrible ways on chimpanzees, that we would now consider terribly unethical, should we keep using the medicine? And the genetic fallacy says, no, you got to look at the origins. But if you do that with America, then you're in trouble because we had a very messy beginning. It was not, it was by far from a pleasant beginning. There were elements that were virtuous, and I think that we can continue to strive for the best American ideals of equality and liberty and general good. But yeah, that I think that's a big problem now in society in terms of what holds us together as Americans, because some people say, I'm not buying this origin myth of these great white men because some of them were slaveholders of my ancestors. So I feel no glue based on the origin myth. So we have to figure out other ways to provide glue for Americans.
We'll be back with more from A.J. Jacobs and the Year of Living Constitutionally in just a moment. You're listening to Writers on Writing. If you're new to the podcast or a longtime listener, I encourage you to check out our Patreon page. If you're liking the show or you've learned any tips that may have inched you closer to publication, this is our way of keeping in touch with you and allows you to keep in touch with us, ask questions of upcoming guests, get little tips from them. And if you like these behind-the-scenes discussions of how these books get made, check us out there, patreon.com/writers on writing. Let's get back to it with AJ Jacobs talking about the year of living constitutionally. So at the end of the book, you kind of summarize some of the either calcification of your thinking or the changes in your thinking or kind of your big takeaways. But I'd love to unpack a little bit of that because I think that's the essence of this whole project was how it changed your mind, either about our politics or our constitution or how things are run. What were the big things that you would say swayed you in a direction that you didn't go into the project thinking?
Well, one was, just since it's about the Constitution, one was the idea of how should we look at the Constitution? Should we look at it as a document of liberation or a document of oppression? And we talked about that a little, but I do love Frederick Douglass's, the great abolitionist, his framing that the Constitution should be seen as a promissory note because it promises these great things like equality and liberty, but America doesn't always deliver on that. So the struggle is to make America live up to this promissory note. And that's what Martin Luther King talked about, and Obama gave a great speech on race about that. So that is one big takeaway. Another big part that changed my mind, and this is a little meta, but I came to love the idea of changing our minds. I think we need to embrace this cognitive flexibility and fluidity. And I think the founders were actually better at this than we are. We, and I include myself, we're very fixated and intransigent in our tribes, and we have a hard time changing our minds when presented with evidence to the contrary. And that is not what the founders intended. Ben Franklin said during the convention, the older he gets, the less certain he is of his own opinions. And he told this great story, which I love. He said, this was at the convention, because he's kind of a jester, a joker. So he said, there's this French lady who said to her sister, it's so strange. Why is it that I'm the only person I've ever met who is right on every single issue? And his point, of course, was, we're all the French lady. We all think that we're right on every single issue. And my favorite last story about a founder changing his mind is James Madison, at least according to lore, but I believe it. On his deathbed, he made a strange face, and his niece, who was there, said, Uncle, what's the matter? And he said, oh, nothing. I just changed my mind. And then he died. So we don't know what he changed his mind about. It could be the wallpaper. It could be the bicameral legislature, but the very fact that the last act he did on earth was to change his mind, I think is just a wonderful metaphor, just a wonderful symbol that we need to change our minds more. And not willy-nilly, like joining a cult is changing your mind, but but looking at the evidence sort of dispassionately and saying, okay, I'm very attached to this belief, but really the evidence seems to indicate otherwise, so I have to accept that.
I think if James Madison was thinking about a bicameral legislature on his deathbed, well, hats off to that guy.
Well, he was a nerd. I mean,
he was a nerd.
Yes, a government nerd, so I would not be surprised. I mean, he was what my kids call a tryhard, because he, before the Constitutional Convention, he spent months reading every book about different forms of government. And really, I gained a lot of respect for him because he came in, and he is called the father of the Constitution for a reason. It is his Constitution in many ways, and other people sort of tweaked around the edges.
Yeah, I hadn't appreciated that before this book. Yeah, this book taught me so much, so many nuances, and really, in fact, I was going to say on the Second Amendment, which I have strong opinions. You know, I barely ever allow myself to entertain the other side, and your book made me entertain the other side. So
that is lovely. Yeah, I believe in something called steel manning, which you might have heard of, but it's the opposite of straw man. Like a straw man is, but steel man, you try to present the other side in as strong a way as possible, because that way when you do make up your mind, you're actually coming from a place of knowledge. And I do come out on the side of more regulations for guns, but I wanted to present both sides just so I don't think presenting it in a very tendentious way is going to sway anyone's mind from the other side. But if you present it in a strong way, both sides, and then say, here's why I believe that we need more regulation, then maybe, just maybe, you'll make some headway.
I'm glad you said that, and this idea of the steel man, which I hadn't really clued in on that phrase before, but I really like this because I was going to ask you about coming into a project with a certain bent. I mean, I don't think I'm spilling the beans here to say that you come to this with a liberal bent of mind,
Right, me too, yeah.
in a very contentious, polarized world. I know you don't want to alienate any conservative readers or anybody, and so part of the onus was on you to come to it with that steel man perspective. And I was wondering if you could talk about a couple of the ways maybe that that may have been tricky and how to put checks on yourself to know that you were giving fair shrift to both sides and kind of how you approached that problem.
Yeah, well, it's great. I mean, I like to, my last book was about the puzzler, puzzles, and my love of puzzles, which you kindly had me on to discuss. So I think one way to approach contentious issues is to see them as a puzzle instead of a war of words. So if I'm talking to someone from the other side of the political spectrum, I used to, my default is to go and just try to argue and present facts and beat them down with my flawless logic. But that just does not work very often. And in fact, it probably is counterproductive. It polarizes them. So instead, I try to approach conversations and I say, well, let's think of this as almost a cooperative puzzle. Why do you believe what you believe? And why do I believe what I believe? What evidence could sway one of us to the other side? And if we can't be swayed, then where do we go from here? Is there any productive action we can take that we would both agree on? So that's the way that I go into these issues. And I will say a lot of what we're talking about is not Republican or Democrat, or it certainly shouldn't be. Something like the fact that the president nowadays is so much more powerful than the founders imagined. And I think that we have to get back to a much more constrained president. The president, let me just bring up one of my favorite facts about the Constitutional Convention was when someone brought up the idea of having a single president, some of the delegates said, "Are you jesting? This is a terrible idea. We just fought a war to get rid of a king, and you want a single president, an elected king?" No, we need at least three presidents. Or Ben Franklin wanted 12 presidents, a council of 12 presidents. And they were voted down, 7 states to 3. But if two other states had voted differently, we would have a three presidents, perhaps. Biden and Trump and JFK and RFK Jr. all hanging out. Now, I don't necessarily think that's a good idea, but their point that the president was a monarch in the making turned out to be true because presidents, both Democrat and Republican, have way more power than they should. War power, trade power, and there are ways to constrain that that don't involve three presidents that we need to implement. And again, I think that should be a bipartisan issue. I think both Democrats and Republicans should agree that a president with that much power is dangerous. And especially if it's the president from the other party, you don't want one person with that much power.
I actually have thought the idea of three presidents isn't a terrible one because, like, how can you be an expert on foreign policy and domestic policy and economics and health? And,
Oh,
like, if you know,
I
but now I
like
guess we're
that.
just breaking things up into departments, which we have. But
Well,
yeah,
no,
I like
that's so
this.
interesting. I hadn't, because one proposal was to have a president from the north, a president from the middle states, and the one from the south. But I like your idea of splitting it up by expertise. Very interesting.
I haven't really thought it through. I'm sure there are, enough overlaps that it would break down, but yeah, I
I'm
was like,
willing to
why
try.
is the same guy who's doing this also has his hand on the nuclear button, also, it's also...
Right. Yeah, well, that's the no one person should have their hand on the nuclear button.
Oof.
That seems like
Especially one specific person. But anyway, yes.
agree.
So let's talk a little bit about your ChatGPT experiment and AI. I know a lot of writers out there are worried. A lot of people in general are out there worried.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about choosing to do that, how it went, how you felt about it during and after, and yeah, sort of your experience with AI and James Madison.
Well, I am terrified of AI, and also I had, I experimented a lot early on, and it was far from accurate. There was a lot of I guess hallucinating, they call it. I remember it. My son asked ChatGPT, "What are the names of AJ Jacobs' kids?" And it just spouted off some amazingly creative but incorrect information, including how I came up with the name. It was Swahili for gazelle. I can't remember. I think the name of my daughter, who I don't have, was Tibby. So anyway, I'm skeptical of ChatGPT, but also in awe of some of its power. And part of this project was to try to get in the minds of the founding fathers. And I thought, well, my kids actually said the closest you can get is ChatGPT, because ChatGPT has swallowed everything James Madison ever wrote or was written about him. And so I went on and I said, okay, well, ChatGPT, take on the persona of James Madison. And it did. And first of all, it went all in. It's like me, it goes all in. So it was like, dear esteemed partner in dialoguing, or that kind of talk. But I would ask it about current events, like what did James Madison think of the AR-15? Should that be covered by the Second Amendment, which was written when muskets were the main weapon? And Chat Robo Madison, as I called him, sort of the Chat GPT Madison, at first he was hemming and hawing, and then I said, just give me a yes or no. And he was not happy about that, but he said, finally, no, I don't think it should be covered by the Second Amendment. So he leaned liberal on that. On other issues, though, he did was more conservative, such as he did think that the bakers in the case where they objected to baking a cake for a gay wedding, he took their side. So he was weirdly split on the liberal conservative. But I will say that he had no problem condemning the 45th president. The fourth president, at least the robotic version, does not like the 45th president. He said he was very concerned about the way he treated the press, about how he claimed presidential immunity, which I do think the founders would be shocked by this
Yes. Yeah.
claim of immunity. And he did not like his use of social media, which he thought was not presidential. So that was fun to just think. Who knows what the real Madison would say, but that was I printed the Robo Madison's thoughts as an experiment.
Well, to his point about our 45th president, he does seem to be the founders' thought experiment for what they were designing the Constitution around,
Yeah, no, you're absolutely a demagogue. They were so
Yeah.
worried about someone who would flatter the public and gain undue power and use it for his own purposes as opposed to the common good. And I think part of the problem was that George Washington, they all respected him so much. And he was, in some ways, this model of self-restraint and virtue and thinking about the greater good, with his huge flaws, of course. So they didn't build in as many guardrails as they might have, thinking, oh, well, we've got George Washington coming up. But not everyone is George Washington.
Yes. Ay, ay, ay. It's funny as you were talking about Benjamin Franklin and you had a little assemblage in your house, not assemblage, an assembly in your house. I love that. We had done like 20, well, it was before our daughter was born. So it was like 25 years ago. We did a Ben Franklin junto, inspired by his juntos.
Oh, yes.
We
Oh,
recreated the
good.
junto in our house to teach each other obscure knowledge. It was the Academy of the Obscure, and we would gather 10 people and teach each other, obscure knowledge that everybody had forgotten about.
I love that idea. So, what
Yeah,
was
it
an
was really fun.
example of an obscure knowledge that you learned or taught?
Yes, we did the origins of alchemy. We did the
Ooh.
origins of zero. We
That's
did
good.
the Knights Templar. Yeah. And then kids were born and things devolved into madness, and that was the end of that. But it was.
Well, I do love that was I had a chapter on our right to assemble, and as you say, I brought together people from different ideological perspectives and to
Yeah.
talk about what they think was right and wrong with the Constitution. And I will say the one thing we agreed on was that that was a very positive experience, and part of it was just being face to face, and it is much harder to become enraged by a person, by an actual human being, than by a faceless troll. So I do think we need to assemble peaceably more often in person.
Yeah, I mean, that was such a good reminder of what is lost when we aren't face to face and having these conversations. Because every time I get together with somebody whose ideological perspectives don't align with mine, I'm shocked how much we have in common when we really
Yes,
start talking about the issues.
right. And
That's
that is
just good
right. I
reminder.
think there are so many bipartisan issues that we are overlooking. For instance, 18-year term limits on the Supreme Court, that polls well with both sides, as it should. It's crazy to have someone who's been on for 40 years and in their 90s trying to get their mind around the internet, which I can't get my mind around, and I'm not 90. So there are many areas that we should be, and gerrymandering, that should be a
Yeah.
bipartisan issue. I mean, no one wants cheating like that, if the other side is doing it.
Well, and I assume the life expectancy was much lower back in the day when they were making these rules. So, if you were only going to live to 45, maybe it's not
Right.
so bad to hold office for life because your life isn't that long. But
Exactly.
there were a lot of
Exactly.
dollar amounts, I believe, in the Constitution. I assume those have been sort of, I don't even know how they deal with those, but they mentioned
No,
the
they
amount.
haven't. That's the weird thing. There is a $20, it's
Yeah.
$20. I believe it's for civil lawsuits. If it's over $20, you need a jury. And yet that has not been inflation adjusted. And if I were
Wow.
writing the Constitution, I would say inflation adjusted $20.
Right.
But it is interesting. I mean, those are two of the fascinating themes within the Constitution. You have some very specific language that's like a contract or a recipe, like $20, 35 years of age to run for president. But then you have these other phrases like whatever is necessary and proper, or the equal protection. And those are so vague. And sometimes in a good way, I think it's good that they are elastic because society has changed so much. But that is where you get into the heart of the disagreements over what does that mean.
Yes. Has this changed how you approach reading in general and, reading very carefully or reading for specificity or changed how you write, trying to be more specific? Or, yeah, tell me if the project
Oh, I
really.
love that. I do think so. I think, well, first, I think I do prefer now reading offline. Even if it's on a Kindle, I still think you can read offline. It just the key is turning off the internet so that you can fully focus. But in terms of, trying to figure out when you're interpreting something, what was the meaning at the time? But also, is that the most important aspect? Because that's the big debate of originalism versus living constitutionalism. Originalism says the meaning of the words when they were written in 1789, that is the most important part. Whereas pragmatists or living constitutionalists or pluralists, they have lots of names. They say, no, that's just one part of it. And I guess I think you have the same debate. I'm not a huge expert on literary theory, but I think there's a debate as well about, is the intention of the author the most important part, or can your reaction to the words be equally valid, even if the author didn't mean it?
Right. And tell me about, you have a wonderful acknowledgments and bibliography. I think your acknowledgments page is 9 pages and your bibliography is like 10 pages, single spaced. There's just right. Like reams of names that make me realize what went into this book. And I'm kind of curious about when you feel satisfied that you've kind of wrapped your arms around a subject so big, and B, well, let's do A first.
Well,
How, when did you,
A
yeah,
is
go
a
ahead.
Tough question. I mean, that's a great question, and I don't have a good answer. It is so hard because I take on these topics that are huge. So I could have spent 50 years researching
Yes.
the Constitution and never, and still have hundreds of books to read. So the real reason I stopped is my deadline. I mean, the publisher, Crown, which, by the way, a very non-patriotic name, Crown, very monarchical, not happy. But they said they really wanted it out in May because they wanted it before the presidential election because it seemed very timely, but not too close to the election because then no one would be paying attention. This was the fastest I've ever written a book. It was not easy. I'm not complaining because I loved writing about it and researching. But I was on Ben Franklin's schedule, which was get up at 5 and work, work, work.
I love a deadline. I love me a deadline as a writer. There's nothing that will light a fire like a deadline.
That's, yes, I have very mixed feelings about it. But in this case, the book would still be being researched if it weren't for that deadline.
I forget what your research was behind how quickly, was it Ben Franklin who was writing so fast? Somebody was writing very fast back in the day. So,
oh, yeah. Well, a lot of them, but certainly Alexander Hamilton.
That was
good. He had a day job. He had his affair, like his extramarital affairs to keep him busy. And yet he wrote these Federalist Papers in just a remarkably short amount of time. So
That's right. It
is amazing.
You can really multitask when you're, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
And did your editor or agent, or I know you had a vast cast of readers for this, was there a lot of feedback that you had to contend with or go back and change things from a editorial point of view, or?
A little bit. I love feedback early on because I want to make sure I'm going in the right direction. So I would write a chapter knowing it was super rough, but I would send it to 10 friends and say, what do you like about this chapter and what do you not like? One of the main notes, which was super helpful, was I'm a history nerd, so I could happily read about obscure history and find it delightful. But not everyone is as into that. So they're like, what is the relevance of this to modern life? And that's where I had to really play it up and think, yes, the reason I'm doing this is because we have this originalist Supreme Court and we have to figure out what does the Constitution mean now and how does it affect our lives and our freedoms and what does it say about America as a democracy that could survive? So all of making sure it really was, even though about the past, it really related to our present struggles.
I mean, they're giving you one gift after the next every day. You know, the Supreme Court is just delivering
Oh, yeah, no, that. Yeah.
one
Thank you,
topical.
Supreme Court.
Thank you, Supreme Court, for
It
delivering
is.
one shocking change after the next. So, yeah, that's
right. Well, even on deadline, I remember the whole 14th Amendment, whether Trump was eligible to run for president, was happening as the book was closing, like as I was doing the final read through. And And I did beg them. I'm like, I gotta get this in there. It's so timely. So I have a page on Trump and the 14th Amendment, and voter eligibility, whether he could run for president. But as soon as it closed, something else came up and I couldn't reopen it. So you like you say, it was amazingly timely.
Oh man. I was just listening to Heather Cox Richardson, my favorite historian,
Oh, sure,
this
yeah.
morning, and she was talking about the 14th Amendment, and she's like, "I stop people in the shopping market to tell them how great that amendment is."
It
I was
is a great, it is one.
like,
I mean, someone asked me my favorite amendment, and that is the one I said.
"Yeah."
That is a, it's a, it changed our country. I mean, there are a lot of historians I talked to call it the second founding. It's that important.
Yeah. Well, is there advice you can leave writers with in terms of, I don't know, any advice you'd leave people with? Certainly take out your longhand pen and turn off the internet. I like that one.
I am a big fan of that. I would say, well, I will say this. I don't know if I talked to myself from 2 years ago or 3 years ago and said that I recommend getting up at 5 a.m., that old me would be very dubious and probably annoyed and roll his eyes. But it really has, it worked for me in terms of getting stuff done. Are you an early riser or a
I
late
am
riser?
not. Yeah, I'm sort of a mid-level riser. I mean, I'm up by 6:30, but
That's pretty early.
there's Wordle to play and, there's a lot of time to waste before I get going.
Understood. Well, I don't think, my last book was that that's not a waste of time. You're doing brain workouts, so I would
That's what I
never
tell
say.
myself, but yeah,
Yeah.
the internet is humming along by 6:30. Yeah. Are you doing a book tour for this one?
Somewhat of. I went around. I've been going around a little. I'm going to Washington, D.C.
Yay.
because that seems appropriate. So, yeah, and I do sign with books with my quill and ink.
Oh.
So I've got that, and I had a book party, which I loved throwing because we served Madeira. And we had, all sorts of. I went into the theme. I leaned in hard.
I love that. Are there
Thank you.
things you'd recommend as I'm asking for advice? Are there things you recommend as not as writers, but as patriots that people do? I know we should all now bake an election cake. I didn't know anything about election cakes until I read this, but now I'm kind of inspired to make an election cake this November.
Please do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are there things you recommend people do beyond vote and bake cakes that you feel could potentially make a difference?
Well, I think baking cakes is a great gateway activity, gateway drug, because, and just quickly, the election cakes was a tradition from the 18th century when they would see election day as a festival and there was music and parades and cakes. And so I revived that by getting hundreds of people across the country to bake election cakes. And just that little positive action was so. For me, it's such an emotionally positive experience because it is such a dark and negative time. And I don't think that's the end. Well, I do think that creating a festive atmosphere is not trivial, that there are studies that it drives up voter turnout when you make it more festive. And Australia has the democracy sausage. They have huge cookout barbecues on election day. So I'm hoping
Oh.
that we adopt the election cake in a real way. But that's not the that is the start. You also have to work on and but there are real reforms we can make. Things like gerrymandering or 18-year term limits for the Supreme Court. Real positive pragmatic actions we can take to make our democracy stronger. And so yeah, let's start with the cake, but not end there and just keep going and looking for ways to increase our democracy, which again should be a bipartisan issue.
Yes. Give DC some senators, for God's sake. And more people than Wyoming. It's not fair.
Absolutely. I know that was another one that I think the founders again would be like, wait, there's 700,000 people in Washington, D.C. who don't have a senator and
Right.
just have a lame congressperson with no power,
Right.
they would be amazed.
Yeah. Well, all this and more the next time you come on. This is always so fun.
I love it. Thank
I
you,
love it
Marie.
too.
And yeah, let's win that award. Come on.
We got this. That was AJ Jacobs. The book is The Year of Living Constitutionally. It's out and available now, published by Crown. In addition to our Patreon page, you can always visit our websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. You can always check out the show's website to get information on past shows and archives of all of our shows, writersonwriting.com. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of AJ's book or any books of our past guests, you can do that on our bookshop.org site. Check us out there, bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting. It's a great way to support independent bookstores and a great way to support the show. As always, our fantastic music and sound design was provided by Travis Barrett. You can find more typewriter music at his site on Spotify under Just My Type. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.